Lecture 18, Dialects, Spoken Style, Written Style.
In the previous few lectures, I've been working with a general implication that languages that are only spoken are in a way more real than languages that are written. And that's an important lesson, and we're going to see more of that a few lectures from now. But there is another truth which is important to realize at the same time, and that is that written languages do have certain what you might call advantages over oral languages. Sometimes you're not supposed to say this too loud, like many things that are true, but a written language has a larger and richer vocabulary than a solely oral language, and in many ways it has a more elaborate kind of syntax and other ways of arranging its words to convey meaning. And that is because of technology. This advantage is a kind of artificial imposition, but that advantage is there. And so the theme is that there is a huge difference between what you can do with a language when it's on the page versus what you can do with a language when you're just using it orally. There's a big difference between spoken language and written language. It can be confusing in a highly literate society such as ours. And so we're going to look at that in this lecture and get a sense of that difference. Spoken language you could call raggedy but effective. But raggedy it is. So, for example, we're going to listen to a short clip of a fundamentalist preacher, namely Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who was a famous African-American politician and preacher. He was from Harlem. And this is him in the late 1960s, and this is one of his sermons. And we're going to hear this example of artful yet spoken language. So here it is.
Keep the faith, baby. As I walk the streets of the Harlems of the world, the black Harlems and the white Harlems, people are depressed. They are frustrated. They are downtrodden. They see no hope. They see no tomorrows. And I say to them always, keep the faith, baby. I say this because all over the world, people are not receiving God. They're not getting the assurances that once were given. Promises have been broken, and their dawn refuses to rise. They're walking in the midnights of sorrow, in the midnight of frustration, in the midnight of despair. Too long have they been promised the good life by the great white fathers. Too long have they waited in vain, black and white, poor and illiterate, for the better jobs, better housing, better education, better hospitals. Yet the conditions have not changed. Except for those who have always lived in the penthouses, for the people who live in the basements, in the cellar, their lives are still drab, ugly, have no hope. And I say to them, keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith, because God's realities always exceed man's fondest dreams. Keep faith in God, whoever your God is. Keep the faith of whatever God you believe in. Keep the faith.
So that was Adam Clayton Powell Jr. That's 1967. Now, that is stirring oratory in its way. But then on the other hand, we have to admit that the sentences are short. There's a certain amount of repetition which you would be disinclined to use on the page. And in general, this is rather simple language. And it's simple in a way that is very common when we use language with our mouths in real time, in rapid-fire conversation, as opposed to putting language on the page where we have more time to reflect. Now, if we actually wrote down what Adam Clayton Powell Jr. said, we would find a rather humble, almost halting kind of passage. It wouldn't look particularly majestic if we wrote it down. And that's partly because we're used to seeing written language as something that's very artificial, beautiful though it can be. So, for example, if we look at a passage from Gibbon's classic, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, then we have language like this. And this is throughout that whole work. This is the kind of text that's used. The whole engagement lasted above 12 hours, till the gradual retreat of the Persians was changed into a disorderly flight, of which the shameful example was given by the principal leaders and the Serenus himself. They were pursued to the gates of Ctesiphon, and the conquerors might have entered the dismayed city if their general, Victor, who was dangerously wounded with an arrow, had not conjured them to desist from such a rash attempt, which must be fatal if it were not successful. Now, that's beautiful, but it's very hard to imagine anybody actually speaking that way. A single sentence stretches on and on and on. A composition teacher would love the way Gibbon wrote. But what's important is that that kind of writing is only possible because there is writing. That kind of language would not be possible if there weren't a such thing as capturing speech on the page. And this is because writing is very conscious and it's slow. And this is especially compared to speech, which we do largely without thinking and which is very rapid. As you know, if you've ever tried to actually write down speech as it was happening, and as you know, if you've ever noticed that you have to master shorthand to be able to do that effectively because speech goes by so quickly, particularly casually and unmonitored. So writing, as much as we're used to doing it, is a very deliberate activity where your brain is turned on in a deliberate way that it isn't when we're speaking, which is something that we are biologically programmed to do on some level. And what that means is that we could not process language that was couched in that written Gibbon style if it were aimed at us in casual conversation all day. We're not designed for it. It's difficult to imagine anyone doing it. They would drive us crazy if they did. This is a kind of language that's designed to be engaged on the page, where it's in front of us, where we can reread, where we're doing something more slow than actual speaking and listening to people speaking to us. So in the Gibbon, one of the passages was, "The gradual retreat of the Persians was changed into a disorderly flight, of which the shameful example was given by the principal leaders." That's a written construction. Nobody speaks English that way. Or if they do, one, they're really kind of putting on the dog, and two, what they're doing is aping a construction that they learned from reading written English. This is not something that, say, a toddler would do. It's not something anyone would do who was not deeply immersed in written English. This is the sort of thing that you can process if you see it on the page, but would have a hard time processing while eating chicken and burping your baby. That's not the way people talk. It would take too much processing. Or the passive, "They were pursued to the gates of Ctesiphon." We would be more likely to say they pursued them to the gates of Ctesiphon. "They were pursued" sounds kind of like a news report, or it sounds like something that's written. And of course, news reports are readings of written language. The passive is not used nearly as much in casual speech in English as it is in written English. Or imagine somebody saying, "If their general, Victor, who was dangerously wounded with an arrow, had not conjured them." No one talks that way. You don't say, "My aunt, who lives in Atlanta, is coming tomorrow." That's a joke, really. Now, you don't laugh at it when it's written, but that particular kind of relative clause is largely a written tick. We have learned to do that as we wrote, but it doesn't have a whole lot to do with the way people speak. So, for example, "Our vacation, which promises to be fun, is coming in August." No, that's not speech. That's writing. And if you see anyone depicted speaking that way, as you often do in, say, a seventh grade or sixth grade vocabulary building book, actually, people don't talk that way. I remember I had a kind of lexicon building book, these vocabulary exercises. I think it was seventh grade, and you got words like assiduous and words that you probably don't know at that age. And the example sentences always had people saying things along the lines of, "Our vacation, which was really quite fun, came to a blah, 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 blah." And I remember always thinking, who are these people who talk this way? No one talks that way. They were putting written language into these supposed living people's mouths. So if language had existed for only 24 hours, writing would have come along at about 11:08 p.m. So that's how new writing is in terms of what language is. And as we've seen, only about 200 out of the 6,000 languages are written in a real way. So writing is an artifice. And as a result, there are regular differences between the way we talk, even as thoroughly poised, intelligent, even educated people, and the way that we write. And these are differences that are very stark and very regularly found between spoken language and written language. So, for example, in speaking, even if one has a PhD, it's been shown that you use a much more limited vocabulary than is available in written language. Now, this is partly because writing allows the preservation of words over time. Under natural conditions where there's no writing and you just talk into the air, if a word drops out of use, after just a few generations, it's gone. When no one remembers that word, there's no way of retrieving it from the air or calling upon the spirits or something like that. Once there's writing, then all the old words get kind of caught in a web and saved in an artificial way. And so, there are a people called the Lokele in the former Zaire, and they use a talking drum language. Now, what's interesting is that they've been doing this for a very long time, and as such, there are many words in what they say on the talking drums in this language that nobody remembers the meaning of. And so it's just these words that you use in these settings. It's kind of like peas, porridge, hot. You know, and you kind of, what, peas, porridge, you know, what does that mean? You could find out, but really we just learn how to say it by rote and we just deal with it. Ring around the rosy, we do something with our bodies going round and round, but what precisely is it? You can look it up. These people, however, you don't look it up because it is a spoken language. There's nothing to look up. They just don't know what many of those words mean because the language has bypassed the point at which the talking drum language was composed. So it's a very natural phenomenon. It's different for us. And so, for example, we know the word ruthless, and then supposedly there's also a word ruth, and ruth means mercy. Now, you can find that in a big dictionary, but we don't use the word, and it isn't marked as obsolete. But really, ruth is not a word. Please show me ruth. No one has said that for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's in the dictionary and therefore is still supposedly a word, but that's only because we have dictionaries. Or in general, you can go through a lifetime still encountering new words. I think 6 months ago I learned sciolism. Sciolism, S-C-I-O-L-I-S-M. A pretentious journalist dropped it into a piece and I wanted to know what it meant. Apparently it means superficial knowledge. So yeah, I learned a new word. That's really not a word. That word is so rare, it is so recherché, that the only reason that it exists at all for that journalist to use and for me to stuff into my head taking up space is because we have the printed page. That can't happen with the Lokele or with any language that is not written down in a real way. So, spoken English makes use of a small subset of all of the words that are kind of on life support sitting in the dictionary. So spoken English uses more or less the number of words that an oral language would use, natural language, that is. So, for example, it's been shown that even educated Americans, say at UC Berkeley, use hedges to compensate for how hard it is to make a maximal use of the vocabulary. So one quote from one piece that analyzes this has someone saying, she was still young enough, so I just was able to put her in a sort of sling. I mean, one of those tummy packs, you know. That's the way people talk. And if you think about it, it is. So this isn't somebody standing in front of a white screen presenting the language in its Sunday best. This is somebody standing in front of a cafe, probably, you know, with a baby carriage or holding something, a bird flies by, and they're just kind of chatting along. Next time you're listening to conversation, notice that it's not like my old vocabulary textbooks. People are always hedging, cleaning things up, fragments, run-ons. That's what we do in America. That's what people do all over the world. That's what language is like. So, languages used orally tend to have thousands or, say, tens of thousands of words. But the idea of a language having hundreds of thousands of words, you can't help thinking, who knows all of those words? And indeed, no one does. Only the dictionary contains them. There's nobody who knows every word in there. Or if there is, they've spent their entire life learning all those words, and it's to compensate for some sense of inadequacy they feel elsewhere in their life. For the most part, we're all too busy actually being human beings. And so, only a written language can have that many words. Then there is the issue of structure. Spoken language generally uses shorter and simpler sentences than written language. This is just normal. And so, for example, here's an oral language. Here's this Saramaccan Creole that I've mentioned before, keeping you in suspense as to what this is. But now we're going to hear some Saramaccan Creole, and this is part of a folk tale. And in the passage we're going to hear, and I'll tell you what he was saying after he says it, you notice that it's in short little sentence packets. So here it goes.
Anasi, dia konde. No have a wamuye bidia di konde nade or di muye apali mi wadaka. Eno fu di apali no de odo simba di konde di ata sien usoni. Have a big garutia we have a gualio. No di agualio de garu kode wamuye mi.
So that was a passage of our mysterious Saramaccan Creole. And even if you didn't know what he said, and chances are most of you don't, you know that it was short sentences. He wasn't talking like Gibbon wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Now, what he was saying was Anansi the spider was in a village, and a woman was in the village there, and the woman bore a child one day. And when she gave birth, the other people in the village didn't want to have anything to do with her. Then she prayed to the gods fervently. Then she went to the river. And when she went to the river, the gods gave her a girl child. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. So that is spoken language. And if you look at passages of people actually speaking rather than reciting a folk tale, you find the same sort of thing. And in fact, as you might intuit, when writing begins of a language, at first people are inclined to write more or less the way they talk. You don't all of a sudden start writing like Gibbon just because you've got a quill in your hand or on the Flintstones a nail and a hammer or whatever it was that they used. These written conventions take a while. It takes a while for you to realize, hey, now that I've got time to work this out on paper, I can come up with something with a kind of hypercoherence that would be impossible with the mess of real life. So, for example, a very early passage of written English comes from something by pioneering printer William Caxton, and it goes like this. This is early written English when there are not yet conventions for the writing of English. Caxton wrote, "And afterward, when I remembered myself of my simpleness and unperfectness that I had in both languages, that is to wit, in French and in English, for in France was I never, and was born and learned my English in Kent in the Weald, where I doubt not is spoken as broad and rude English as is in any place of England, and have continued by the space of 30 years for the most part in the countries of Brabant, Flanders, Holland, and Zealand." It just goes on like that. There's no sense of written style, and it's not that he was a lout, it's that no one knew how to write yet. It's the sort of thing that you would imagine. And in a way, it reflects something that's true of us. It's the sobering reality of how we actually speak English rather than write it. So, for example, this is my rendition of transcriptions of college students in the 1970s, and they are talking the way most, if not all of us, talk at many parts of our lives. And so these are two people having a conversation. This is the 1970s. On a tree. Carbon isn't going to do much for a tree, really. The only thing it can do is collect moisture, which may be good for it. In other words, in the desert, you have the carbon granules, which would collect moisture on top of them. Yeah. It doesn't help the tree, but it keeps the moisture in. Because then it just soaks up moisture. It works by the water molecules adhere to the carbon molecules that are in the ashes. It holds it on. And the plant takes it away from there. Then the other person says, "Oh, I have an argument with you." And the other person says, "Yeah." And the other person says, "You know, you said how silly it was about my, well, it's not a theory at all, that the more pregnant you are and you see spots before your eyes, it's proven that it's the retention of the water." The other one says, "Yeah, the water's just gurgling all your eyes." Now, that's not Gibbon And there are all these hesitations, there are outright flubs and sentences that go on and on, corrections. And yet, that is most certainly the way I experience people of all walks of life talking when there's no tape recorder and there's no reason to be trying to be obnoxiously perfect. That's just the way spoken English tends to sound. So, for example, you could take language like that and make it into written language, but it would be a translation. You'd have to work to do it. It would be almost like working with two different languages. So, for example, this is a passage about the purchase of a dog. And this is from Great Britain. And so there's a use of the word bitch, which is meant sincerely to refer to a female dog. So this is not profane. In Britain, the word bitch doesn't have quite the sting that it does for us because they actually use it to refer to female dogs without laughing. So that's what's going on in this passage. So somebody says, I had to wait. I had to wait till it was born, until it got to about 8 or 10 weeks of age. Then I bought my first dachshund, a black and tan bitch puppy, as they told me I should have bought a bitch puppy to start off with, because if she wasn't 100% good, I could choose a top champion dog to mate her to and then produce something that was good, which would be in my own kennel prefix. And this is a Brit, so our sense that they somehow speak better than us, this is them talking exactly the way we talk. Just jumping from sentence to sentence to sentence and making themselves perfectly clear. That was a perfectly articulate person. But what she did not say is what the translated written version of that could be, which could be something like, some 8 or 10 weeks after the birth saw my first acquisition of a dachshund, a black and tan bitch puppy. It seems that a bitch puppy would have been the appropriate initial purchase because of the possibility of mating an imperfect specimen with a top champion dog, the improved offspring then carrying my own kennel prefix. Nobody talks like that. That's lovely, but nobody would actually put it that way. And that's because there's this difference between spoken and written language. And it's always there. There's nothing that can be done about it. So, another example of how early language is more like, early writing is more like natural language than the kind of writing that we're used to today, is even something like, for one, Homer, or the Bible. The Hebrew Bible is written by people who obviously are used to thinking of language as something that is either said or recited for an audience, and only secondarily is put on the page. The Hebrew Bible is not written in what we would consider written style. So, for example, we're used to the very beginning of that book in question going something like, in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, the earth was a formless wasteland, and darkness covered the abyss, while a mighty wind swept over the waters. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. So all of this is very smooth. It's kind of like, you know, Velveeta. It kind of goes very easily down. Velveeta has been found, actually, in garages, preserved in perfect form since 1957. Apparently, it does not rot. And yet we eat it all the time. I don't know if that story is true, but it sounds funny. Anyway, in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless wasteland and darkness covered the abyss. While a mighty wind swept over the waters, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. That took work. That is not the way it was originally put. People who are Jewish and or are particularly interested in such things are familiar with the original Hebrew version, and you can even tell from the pacing. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. Ve'haaretz hayta tohu vavohu. Ve'choshek al pnei tehom ve'ruach. Elohim merafechet al pnei hamayim. Vayomer Elohim yehior vayehior. And it goes like that. That's, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Boom. And the earth was formless and empty. Boom. With darkness on the face of the depths. God's spirit moved on the water's surface. Boom. God said, there shall be light, and light came into existence. Dum, dum, dum. Now, you can call that majestic. There's a certain pleasing chunkiness and straightforwardness about it. But it's not as if they had a choice. That's the only way they would have known how to write. The conventions of Gibbon didn't exist yet. So there's certainly a beauty, the beauty of the simple, but this is the way the earliest writing of languages tends very strongly to go, because these people are just scratching down what they say, and what they say is spoken language. So what this means is that What we often think of as real language, as the best language, is something which is of a latecomer in human history. It's something that was not going on during most of the time that human beings were walking around and speaking. It's something that came along only at 11:08 p.m., so to speak. And we often look at language on the page and we think of ourselves when we're speaking as somehow not measuring up to that. But the fact is that there is a place for spoken language. And so, for example, if you listen to a well-told joke, the joke is not told in the language of Gibbon. If you actually wrote down the joke, you would find that it was in short little phrases, and that there would often be a lot of cleanups and hesitations and fragments and run-ons. And yet, that's what makes a joke work. If you are watching speeches at a political convention, especially in our era, anyone who got up and spoke in paragraphs and chapters with the "in which the leaders would have been proud," etc., this sort of thing would not go over very well. It wouldn't be considered effective. It wouldn't go to the gut. It would be hard to show oneself as a human being with meat and pith using language like that. It's the art of spoken language which becomes necessary. And it's important to realize that spoken language, while it's simpler in terms of vocabulary and syntactic structure, can also be artful too. So there was nothing wrong with Adam Clayton Powell Jr.'s speech. There's nothing wrong with any fundamentalist preacher's speeches or sermons along those lines, even though it tends to be in this simple kind of language. There are all kinds of song lyrics that a lot of us probably cherish that are in very short lines. None of us would want to hear Gibbon set to music. That would not be a hit. We would not listen to it. Gibbon belongs where Gibbon is. Our songs tend to be written in spoken language. That's worldwide, and therefore it's true in America too. So you can be artful in spoken language. You can be not artful in spoken language. You could, for example, be, you know, a public official who can't rub a noun and a verb together. That can happen. In the same way, you can write very well, and that is given. You can also write very badly. You can use written language in a way that the sentences go on way too long. Vocabulary is used of an advanced nature just because the person can. In other words, these are two different kinds of language, and they can both be used well or badly. But very different they are. There are two other things to remember about written language in terms of advantage and disadvantage. One advantage is that with written language, you can deal in long lines of argument, and therefore sustained argument, which is much harder in the back and forth, real time kind of conversation that actual spoken language is. So, for example, you can take a point by point argumentation complete with corollaries and hesitations and footnotes, which cannot be said. That doesn't work in real life. It's not something that humans came up with spontaneously as a way to use their mouths. But then there's a cross-fertilization in that once you have that kind of argumentation on paper, such as in works of philosophy or historical analysis, then you can learn to talk that way. So, for example, there was a time when a public official could make a speech in a spoken version of written language of this kind. Susan B. Anthony traveled the country doing an almost Socratic dialogue about giving women their rights, and it was based on the kind of argument which you couldn't make just standing up at a meeting, which you couldn't make by just stringing short phrases together. That was something that was good about written language in that it increased the value of political discourse, particularly in a distant day. We tend not to make speeches like that today, but there was a time when that was ordinary. On the other hand, there is a disadvantage to written language in terms of the technology that allows it. This was less of a problem when it was a matter of writing on paper, and less of a problem when we had gone from that to printing. But today, we have a word processing problem. And what I mean by that is that it's very, very easy to produce writing now because you have a keyboard with the feather light touch, and the letters are right there. There's no whiteout. There's no physical effort. And as a result, ever since word processing, books have been getting longer and longer and longer. As I do this taping, not long ago, Bill Clinton's autobiography was released, and it's about 400,000 pages long and will be read all the way through by very, very few people. That's a problem. In general, there are books of vital political analysis that are so long that they'd function better as doorstops than as things to read. People tend not to think about how hard it is to read that much material. In any case, there are the good things, there are the bad things, but it's important to remember that written language is kind of like a dog that has been trained to bring in the newspaper. It's cute when a dog brings in the paper. Golden Retriever, after about 6 times, you can teach it to bring in the paper. But it's an artifice. It's something that came along later. It wasn't happening in the wild.